iron fence to look at a rambling Victorian home flanked on both sides by newer brick buildings. These were connected to the Victorian by covered walkways. There was a turret at the top of the mansion on the left side, but none on the right, giving the place a queerly unbalanced look that Dan sort of liked. It was as if the big old girl were saying, "Yeah, part of me fell off. What the fuck? Someday it'll happen to you." He started to smile. Then the smile died. Tony was in the window of the turret room, looking down at him. He saw Dan looking up and waved. The same solemn wave Dan remembered from his childhood, when Tony had come often. Dan closed his eyes, then opened them. Tony was gone. Had never been there in the first place. How could he have been? The window was boarded up. The sign on the lawn, gold letters on a green background, the same shade as the house itself, read, "Helen Rivington House." "They have a cat in there," he thought. "A gray cat named Audrey." This turned out to be partly right and partly wrong. There was a cat, and it was gray, but it was a neutered tom, and its name wasn't Audrey. Dan looked at the sign for a long time, long enough for the clouds to part and send down a biblical beam, and then he walked on. Although the sun was now bright enough to twinkle the chrome of the few slant-parked cars in front of Olympia Sports and the Fresh Day Spa, the snow still swirled, making Dan think of something his mother had said during similar spring weather long ago when they had lived in Vermont. "The devil's beating his wife." 3. A block or two up from the hospice, Dan stopped again. Across the street from the town municipal building was the Fraser Town Common. There was an acre or two of lawn, just beginning to show green, a bandstand, a softball field, a paved basketball half-court, picnic tables, even a putting green, all very nice, but what interested him was a sign reading, "Visit Teeny Town, Fraser's Small Wonder, and ride the Teeny Town Railway." It didn't take a genius to see that Teeny Town was a teeny replica of Cranmore Avenue. There was the Methodist church he had passed, its steeple rising all of 7 feet into the air. There was the Music Box Theater, Spondulik's Ice Cream, Mountain Books, Shirts and Stuff, the Fraser Gallery, Fine Prints Our Specialty. There was also a perfect waist-high miniature of the single-turreted Helen Rivington house, although the two flanking brick buildings had been omitted, perhaps, Dan thought, because they were but ugly, especially compared to the centerpiece. Beyond Teeny Town was a miniature train with Teeny Town Railway painted on passenger cars that were surely too small to hold anyone larger than toddler size. Smoke was puffing from the stack of a bright red locomotive about the size of a Honda Goldwing motorcycle. He could hear the rumble of a diesel engine. Printed on the side of the loco, in old-fashioned gold-flake letters, was the Helen Rivington. Town patroness, Dan supposed. Somewhere in Fraser there was probably a street named after her, too. He stood where he was for a bit, although the sun had gone back in and the day had grown cold enough for him to see his breath. As a kid, he'd always wanted an electric train set and had never had one. Yonder in Teeny Town was a jumbo version kids of all ages could love. He shifted his duffel bag to his other shoulder and crossed the street. Hearing Tony again and seeing him was unsettling, but right now he was glad he'd stopped here. Maybe this really was the place he'd been looking for, the one where he'd finally find a way to write his dangerously tipped life. "You take yourself with you wherever you go." He pushed the thought into a mental closet. It was a thing he was good at. There was all sorts of stuff in that closet. 4. A cowling surrounded the locomotive on both sides, but he spied a footstool standing beneath one low eave of the Teeny Town station, carried it over, and stood on it. The driver's cockpit contained two sheepskin-covered bucket seats, It looked to Dan as if they had been scavenged from an old Detroit muscle car. The cockpit and controls also looked like modified Detroit stock, with the exception of an old-fashioned Z-shaped shifter jutting up from the floor. There was no shift pattern. The original knob had been replaced with a grinning skull wearing a bandana faded from red to pallid pink by years of gripping hands. The top half of the steering wheel had been cut off, so that what remained looked like the steering yoke of a light plane. Painted in black on the dashboard, fading but legible, was "Top speed 40. Do not exceed."
"Like it?"
the voice came from directly behind him. Dan wheeled around, almost falling off the stool. A big weathered hand gripped his forearm, steadying him. It was a guy who looked to be in his late 50s or early 60s, wearing a padded denim jacket and a red-checked hunting cap with the ear flaps down. In his free hand was a toolkit with "Property of Fraser Municipal Department" Dymo taped across the top. "Hey, sorry," Dan said, stepping off the stool. "I didn't mean to."
"It's all right. People stop to look all the time. Usually model train buffs. It's like a dream come true for 'em. We keep 'em away in the summer when the place is jumping and the riv runs every hour or so. But this time of year, there's no we, just me. And I don't mind."
He stuck out his hand.
"Billy Freeman, town maintenance crew. The riv's my baby."
Dan took the offered hand. "Dan Torrance." Billy Freeman eyed the duffel.
"Just got off the bus, I imagine. Or are you riding your thumb?"
"Bus," Dan said. "What does this thing have for an engine?"
"Well, now, that's interesting. Probably never heard of the Chevrolet Veraneo, did ya?"
He hadn't, but knew anyway. Because Freeman knew. Dan didn't think he'd had such a clear shine in years. It brought a ghost of delight that went back to earliest childhood before he had discovered how dangerous the shining could be. Brazilian Suburban, wasn't it? Turbo diesel. Freeman's bushy eyebrows shot up and he grinned.
"Goddamn right! Casey Kingsley, he's the boss, bought it at an auction last year. It's a corker. Pulls like a son of a bitch. The instrument panel's from a Suburban, too. The seats I put in myself."
The shine was fading now, but Dan got one last thing. "From a GTO judge." Freeman beamed.
"That's right. Found him in a junkyard over Sunapee way. The shifter's a hi-hat from a 1961 Mack 9-speed. Nice, huh? You looking for work or just looking?"
Dan blinked at the sudden change of direction. Was he looking for work? He supposed he was. The hospice he'd passed on his amble up Cranmore Avenue would be the logical place to start, and he had an idea, didn't know if it was a shining or just ordinary intuition, that they'd be hiring, but he wasn't sure he wanted to go there just yet. Seeing Tony in the turret window had been unsettling. "Also, Danny, you want to be a little bit farther down the road from your last drink before you show up there asking for a job application for him. Even if the only thing they got is running a buffer on a night shift." Dick Halloran's voice. Christ. Dan hadn't thought of Dick in a long time. Maybe not since Wilmington. With summer coming, a season for which Fraser most definitely had a reason, people would be hiring for all sorts of things. But if he had to choose between a Chili's at the local mall and Teeny Town, he definitely chose Teeny Town. He opened his mouth to answer Freeman's question, but Halloran spoke up again before he could. "You closing in on the big 3-0, honey. You could be running out of chances." Meanwhile, Billy Freeman was looking at him with open and artless curiosity. "Yes," he said, "I'm looking for work."
"Working in Teeny Town wouldn't last long, you know. Once summer comes and the school's let out, Mr. Kingsley hires local. 18 to 22, mostly. The select men expect it. Also, kids work cheap."
He grinned, exposing holes where a couple of teeth had once resided.
"Still, there are worse places to make a buck. Outdoor work don't look so good today, but it won't be cold like this much longer."
No, it wouldn't be. There were tarps over a lot of stuff on the common, but they'd be coming off soon, exposing the superstructure of small-town resort summer. Hot dog stands, ice cream booths, a a circular something that looked to Dan like a merry-go-round. And there was the train, of course, the one with the teeny passenger cars and the big turbo-diesel engine. If he could stay off the sauce and prove trustworthy, Freeman, or the boss, Kingsley, might let him drive it a time or two. He'd like that. Farther down the line, when the municipal department hired the just-out-of-school local kids, there was always the hospice. If he decided to stay, that was. "You better stay somewhere," Halloran said. This was Dan's day for hearing voices and seeing visions, it seemed. "You better stay somewhere soon, or you won't be able to stay anywhere." He surprised himself by laughing. "It sounds good to me, Mr. Freeman. It sounds really good."
5. "Done any grounds maintenance?" Billy Freeman asked. They were walking slowly along the flank of the train. The tops of the cars only came up to Dan's chest, making him feel like a giant.
"I can weed, plant, and paint. I know how to run a leaf blower and a chainsaw. I can fix small engines if the problem isn't too complicated. And I can manage a riding mower without running over any little kids. The train, now, that I don't know about."
"You'd need to get cleared by Kingsley for that. Insurance and shit. Listen, if you get references, Mr. Kingsley won't hire without him."
A few, mostly janitorial and hospital orderly stuff. "Mr. Freeman..."
"Just Billy'll do."
"Your train doesn't look like it could carry passengers, Billy. Where would they sit?" Billy grinned.
"Wait here. See if you think this is as funny as I do. I never get tired of it."
Freeman went back to the locomotive and leaned in. The engine, which had been idling lazily, began to rev and send up rhythmic jets of dark smoke. There was a hydraulic whine along the whole length of the Helen Rivington. Suddenly, the roofs of the passenger wagons and the yellow caboose, 9 cars in all, began to rise. To Dan, it looked like the tops of 9 identical convertibles all going up at the same time. He bent down to look in the windows and saw hard plastic seats running down the center of each car. 6 in the passenger wagons and 2 in the caboose, 50 in all. When Billy came back, Dan was grinning. "Your train must look very weird when it's full of passengers."
"Oh, yeah. People laugh their asses off and burn yay film taking pictures. Watch this."
There was a steel-plated step at the end of each passenger car. Billy used one, walked down the aisle, and sat. A peculiar optical illusion took hold, making him look larger than life. He waved grandly to Dan, who could imagine 50 Brobdingnagians dwarfing the train upon which they rode, pulling grandly out of Teeny Town Station. As Billy Freeman rose and stepped back down, Dan applauded.
"I'll bet you sell about 1 billion postcards between Memorial Day and Labor Day." "Bet your ass!"
Billy rummaged in his coat pocket, brought out a battered pack of Duke cigarettes, a cut-rate brand Dan knew well, sold in bus stations and convenience stores all over America, and held it out. Dan took one. Billy lit them up.
"I better enjoy it while I can," Billy said, looking at his cigarette. "Smoking'll be banned here before too many more years. Frasier Women's Club's already talking about it. Bunch of old biddies, if you ask me, but you know what they say. The hand that rocks the fucking cradle rules the fucking world."
He jetted smoke from his nostrils.
"Not that most of them have rocked a cradle since Nixon was president, or needed a Tampax for that matter."
"Might not be the worst thing," Dan said. "Kids copy what they see in their elders." He thought of his father. The only thing Jack Torrance had liked better than a drink, his mother had once said, not long before she died, was 12 drinks. Of course, what Wendy had liked was her cigarettes, and they had killed her. Once upon a time, Dan had promised himself he'd never get going with that habit either. He had come to believe that life was a series of ironic ambushes. Billy Freeman looked at him, one eye squinted mostly shut.
"I got feelings about people sometimes, and I got one about you."
He pronounced "got" as "gut" in the New England fashion.
"Had it even before you turned around and I saw your face. I think you might be the right guy for the spring cleaning I'm looking at between now and the end of May. That's how it feels to me, and I trust my feelings. Probably crazy.
Dan didn't think it was crazy at all, and now he understood why he had heard Billy Freeman's thoughts so clearly and without even trying. He remembered something Dick Halloran had told him once. Dick, who had been his first adult friend. Lots of people have got a little of what I call a shiny, but mostly it's just a twinkle, the kind of thing that lets them know what the DJ is going to play next on the radio or that the phone's going to ring pretty soon. Billy Freeman had that little twinkle, that gleam.
I guess this Carrie Kingsley would be the one to talk to, huh? Casey, not Carrie. But yeah, he's the man. He's run municipal services in this town for 25 years.
When would be a good time?
Right about now, I should think, Billy pointed. Yonder pile of bricks across the street's the Frazier Municipal Building and town offices. Mr. Kingsley's in the basement, end of the hall. You'll know you're there when you hear disco music coming down through the ceiling. There's a ladies' aerobics class in the gym every Tuesday and Thursday.
All right, Dan said. That's just what I'm going to do.
Got your references?
Yes, Dan patted the duffel which he had leaned against Teeny Town Station.
And you didn't write them yourself, no nothing?
Danny smiled. No, they're straight goods.
Then go get 'em, Tiger.
Okay.
One other thing, Billy said as Dan started away. He's death on drinking. If you're a drinking man and he asks you, my advice is lie.
Dan nodded and raised his hand to show he understood. That was a lie he had told before. 6. Judging by his vein-congested nose, Casey Kingsley had not always been death on drinking. He was a big man who didn't so much inhabit his small, cluttered office as wear it. Right now, he was rocked back in the chair behind his desk, going through Dan's references, which were neatly kept in a blue folder. The back of Kingsley's head almost touched the downstroke of a plain wooden cross hanging on the wall beside a framed photo of his family. In the picture, a younger, slimmer Kingsley posed with his wife and three bathing-suited kiddos on a beach somewhere. Through the ceiling, only slightly muted, came the sound of the village people singing YMCA, accompanied by the enthusiastic stomp of many feet. Dan imagined a gigantic centipede, one that had recently been to the local hairdresser and was wearing a bright red leotard about 9 yards long.
Uh-huh, Kingsley said. Uh-huh. Yep. Right.
There was a glass jar filled with hard candies on the corner of his desk. Without looking up from Dan's thin sheaf of references, he took off the top, fished one out, and popped it into his mouth.
Help yourself, he said.
No, thank you, Dan said. A queer thought came to him. Once upon a time, his father had probably sat in a room like this, being interviewed for the position of caretaker at the Overlook Hotel. What had he been thinking? That he really needed a job? That it was his last chance? Maybe. Probably. But of course Jack Torrance had had hostages to fortune. Dan did not. He could drift on for a while if this didn't work out, or try his luck at the hospice. But he liked the town common. He liked the train, which made adults of ordinary size look like Goliaths. He liked Teeny Town, which was absurd and cheerful, and somehow brave in its self-important small-town America way. And he liked Billy Freeman, who had a pinch of the shining and probably didn't even know it. Above them, YMCA was replaced by I Will Survive. As if he had just been waiting for a new tune, Kingsley slipped Dan's references back into the folder's pocket and passed them across the desk.
He's going to turn me down.
But after a day of accurate intuitions, this one was off the mark.
These look fine, but it strikes me that you'd be a lot more comfortable working at Central New Hampshire Hospital or the hospice here in town. You might even qualify for home helpers. I see you've got a few medical and first aid qualifications. Know your way around a defibrillator, according to these. Heard of Home Helpers?
Yes, and I thought about the hospice. Then I saw the town common and teeny town and the train.
Kingsley grunted.
Probably wouldn't mind taking a turn at the controls, would you?
Dan lied without hesitation. No, sir, I don't think I'd care for that. To admit he'd like to sit in the scavenged GTO driver's seat and lay his hands on that cut-down steering wheel would almost certainly lead to a discussion of his driver's license, then to a further discussion of how he'd lost it, and then to an invitation to leave Mr. Casey Kingsley's office forthwith. I'm more of a raking lawnmower guy.
More of a short-term employment guy, too, from the looks of this paperwork.
I'll settle someplace soon. I've worked most of the wanderlust out of my system, I think. He wondered if that sounded as bullshitty to Kingsley as it did to him.
Short term's about all I can offer you, Kingsley said. Once the schools are out for the summer.
Billy told me, if I decide to stay once summer comes, I'll try the hospice. In fact, I might put in an early application unless you'd rather I don't do that.
I don't care either way.
Kingsley looked at him curiously.
Dying people don't bother you?
Your mother died there, Danny thought. The shine wasn't gone after all, it seemed. It was hardly even hiding. You were holding her hand when she passed. Her name was Ellen.
No, he said, then with no reason why he added, we're all dying. The world's just a hospice with fresh air.
A philosopher yet?
Well, Mr. Torrance, I think I'm going to take you on. I trust Billy's judgment. He rarely makes a mistake about people. Just don't show up late, don't show up drunk, and don't show up with red eyes and smelling of weed. If you do any of those things, down the road you'll go, because the Rivington House won't have a thing to do with you. I'll make sure of it. Are we clear on that?
Dan felt a throb of resentment, a vicious prick, but suppressed it. This was Kingsley's playing field and Kingsley's ball. Crystal.
You can start tomorrow, if that suits. There are plenty of rooming houses in town. I'll make a call or two if you want. Can you stand paying 90 a week until your first paycheck comes in?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Kingsley.
Kingsley waved a hand.
In the meantime, I'd recommend the Red Roof Inn. My ex-brother-in-law runs it. He'll give you a rate. We good?
We are. It had all happened with remarkable speed, the way the last few pieces drop into a complicated 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. Dan told himself not to trust the feeling. Kingsley rose. He was a big man, and it was a slow process. Dan also got to his feet, and when Kingsley stuck his ham of a hand over the cluttered desk, Dan shook it. Now from overhead came the sound of KC and the Sunshine Band telling the world that's the way they liked it, oh-ho, uh-huh.
I hate that boogie-down shit, Kingsley said.
No, Danny thought. You don't. It reminds you of your daughter, the one who doesn't come around much anymore, because she still hasn't forgiven you.
You all right? Kingsley asked. You look a little pale.
Just tired. It was a long bus ride. The shining was back and strong. The question was, why now?
7. 3 days into the job, ones Dan spent painting the bandstand and blowing last fall's dead leaves off the common, Kingsley ambled across Cranmore Avenue and told him he had a room on Elliott Street if he wanted it. Private bathroom part of the deal, tub and shower, $85 a week. Dan wanted it.
Go on over on your lunch break, Kingsley said. Ask for Mrs. Robertson. He pointed a finger that was showing the first gnarls of arthritis. And don't you fuck up, Sonny Jim, because she's an old pal of mine. Remember that I vouched for you on some pretty thin paper and Billy Freeman's intuition.
Dan said he wouldn't fuck up, but the extra sincerity he tried to inject into his voice sounded phony to his own ears. He was thinking of his father again, reduced to begging jobs from a wealthy old friend after losing his teaching position in Vermont. It was strange to feel sympathy for a man who had almost killed you, but the sympathy was there.
Had people felt it necessary to tell his father not to fuck up? Probably. And Jack Torrance had fucked up anyway. Spectacularly. 5 stars. Drinking was undoubtedly a part of it, but when you were down, some guys just seemed to feel an urge to walk up your back and plant a foot on your neck instead of helping you to stand. It was lousy, but so much of human nature was. Of course, when you were running with the bottom dogs, what you mostly saw were paws, claws, and assholes.
And see if Billy can find some boots that'll fit you. He squirreled away about 12 pairs in the equipment shed, although the last time I looked, only half of them matched.
The day was sunny, the air balmy. Dan, who was working in jeans and a Utica Blue Sox t-shirt, looked up at the nearly cloudless sky and then back at Casey Kingsley.
Yeah, I know how it looks. But this is mountain country, pal. Noah claims we're going to have a nor'easter, and it'll drop maybe a foot. Won't last long. Poor man's fertilizer is what New Hampshire folks call April snow, but there's also going to be gale-force winds. So they say. I hope you can use a snowblower as well as a leaf blower. He paused. I also hope your back's okay, because you and Billy will be picking up plenty of dead limbs tomorrow. Might be cutting up some fallen trees, too. You okay with a chainsaw?
Yes, sir, Dan said.
Good.
8. Dan and Mrs. Robertson came to amicable terms. She even offered him an egg salad sandwich and a cup of coffee in the communal kitchen. He took her up on it, expecting all the usual questions about what had brought him to Fraser and where he had been before. Refreshingly, there were none. Instead, she asked him if he had time to help her close the shutters on the downstairs windows in case they really did get what she called a kappa wind. Dan agreed. There weren't many mottos he lived by, but one was always get in good with the landlady. You never know when you might have to ask her for a rent extension. Back on the common, Billy was waiting with a list of chores. The day before, the two of them had taken the tarps off all the kiddie rides. That afternoon, they put them back on and shuttered the various booths and concessions. The day's final job was backing the Riv into her shed. Then they sat in folding chairs beside the teeny town station, smoking.
"Tell you what, Dan'l," Billy said. "I'm one tired, hired man."
"You're not the only one." But he felt okay, muscles limber and tingling. He'd forgotten how good outdoors work could be when you weren't also working off a hangover. The sky had scummed over with clouds. Billy looked up at them and sighed.
"I hope to God it don't snow and blow as hard as the radio says, but it probably will. I found you some boots. They don't look like much, but at least they match."
Dan took the boots with him when he walked across town to his new accommodations. By then the wind was picking up and the day was growing dark. That morning, Fraser had felt on the edge of summer. This evening the air held the face-freezing dampness of coming snow. The side streets were deserted and the houses buttoned up. Dan turned the corner from Moorhead Street onto Elliott and paused. Blowing down the sidewalk, attended by a skeletal scudder of last year's autumn leaves, was a battered top hat, such as a magician might wear. Or maybe an actor in an old musical comedy, he thought. Looking at it made him feel cold in his bones, because it wasn't there. Not really. He closed his eyes, slow counted to 5 with the strengthening wind flapping the legs of his jeans around his shins, then opened them again. The leaves were still there, but the top hat was gone. It had just been the shining, producing one of its vivid, unsettling, and usually senseless visions. It was always stronger when he'd been sober for a little while, but never as strong as it had been since coming to Fraser. It was as if the air here were different somehow, more conducive to those strange transmissions from planet elsewhere. Special. The way the Overlook was special.
"No," he said. "No, I don't believe that."
"A few drinks and it all goes away, Danny. Do you believe that?"
Unfortunately, he did. 9. Mrs. Robertson's was a rambling old colonial, and Dan's third-floor room had a view of the mountains to the west. That was a panorama he could have done without. His recollections of the overlook had faded to hazy gray over the years, but as he unpacked his few things, a memory surfaced. And it was a kind of surfacing, like some nasty organic artifact, the decayed body of a small animal, say, floating to the surface of a deep lake. It was dusk when the first real snow came. We stood on the porch of that big old empty hotel, my dad in the middle, my mom on one side, me on the other. He had his arms around us. It was okay then. He wasn't drinking then. At first, the snow fell in perfectly straight lines, but then the wind picked up, and it started to blow sideways, drifting against the sides of the porch and coating those. He tried to block it off, but it got through. Those hedge animals, the ones that sometimes moved around when you weren't looking. He turned away from the window. His arms rashed out in goose flesh. He'd gotten a sandwich from the Red Apple store and had planned to eat it while he started the John Sanford paperback he'd also picked up at the Red Apple, but after a few bites he rewrapped the sandwich and put it on the windowsill where it would stay cold. He might eat the rest later, although he didn't think he'd be staying up much past 9 tonight. If he got 100 pages into the book, he'd be doing well. Outside, the wind continued to rise. Every now and then gave a blood-curdling scream around the eaves that made him look up from his book. Around 8:30, the snow began. It was heavy and wet, quickly coating his window and blocking his view of the mountains. In a way, that was worse. The snow had blocked the windows in the overlook, too. First just on the first floor, then on the second, and finally on the third. Then they had been entombed with the lively dead. My father thought they'd make him the manager. All he had to do was show his loyalty by giving them his son. His only begotten son, Dan muttered, then looked around as if someone else had spoken. And indeed, he did not feel alone. Not quite alone. The wind shrieked down the side of the building again, and he shuddered. Not too late to go back down to the Red Apple, grab a bottle of something, put all these unpleasant thoughts to bed. No, he was going to read his book. Lucas Davenport was on the case, and he was going to read his book. He closed it at 9:15 and got into another rooming house bed. I won't sleep, he thought. Not with the wind screaming like that. But he did. 10. He was sitting at the mouth of the storm drain, looking down a scrub grass slope at the Cape Fear River and the bridge that spanned it. The night was clear, and the moon was full. There was no wind, no snow, and the overlook was gone. Even if it hadn't burned to the ground during the tenure of the peanut farmer president, it would have been over 1,000 miles from here. So why was he so frightened? Because he wasn't alone. That was why. There was someone behind him. Want some advice, honey bear? The voice was liquid, wavering. Dan felt a chill go rushing down his back. His legs were colder still, prickled out in star points of goose flesh. He could see those white bumps because he was wearing shorts. Of course he was wearing shorts. His brain might be that of a grown man, but it was currently sitting on top of a 5-year-old's body. Honey Bear? Who? But he knew. He had told Deanie his name, but she didn't use it, just called him Honey Bear instead. You don't remember that. And besides, this is just a dream. Of course it was. He was in Fraser, New Hampshire, sleeping while a spring snowstorm howled outside Mrs. Robertson's rooming house. Still, it seemed wiser not to turn around. And safer, that too. "No advice," he said, looking out at the river in the full moon. "I've been advised by experts. The bars and barber shops are full of them."
"Stay away from the woman in the hat, honey bear."
"What hat?" he could have asked, but really, why bother? He knew the hat she was talking about because he had seen it blowing down the sidewalk, black as sin on the outside, lined with white silk on the inside.
"She's the queen bitch of Castle Hill. If you mess with her, she'll eat you alive."
He turned his head. He couldn't help it. Deanie was sitting behind him in the storm drain with the bum's blanket wrapped around her naked shoulders. Her hair was plastered to her cheeks. Her face was bloated and dripping. Her eyes were cloudy. She was dead, probably years in her grave.
"You're not real," Dan tried to say, but no words came out. He was five again. Danny was five. The overlook was ashes and bones, but here was a dead woman one he had stolen from.
"It's all right," she said, bubbling voice coming from a swollen throat.
"I sold the coke. Stepped on it first with a little sugar and got 200.
She grinned and water spilled through her teeth.
"I liked you, honey bear. That's why I came to warn you. Stay away from the woman in the hat."
"False face," Dan said, but it was Danny's voice, the high, frail, chanting voice of a child. "False face, not there, not real." He closed his eyes as he had often closed them when he had seen terrible things in the overlook. The woman began to scream, but he wouldn't open his eyes. The screaming went on, rising and falling, and he realized it was the scream of the wind. He wasn't in Colorado, and he wasn't in North Carolina. He was in New Hampshire. He'd had a bad dream, but the dream was over.
11. According to his Timex, it was 2 in the morning. The room was cold, but his arms and chest were slimy with sweat.
"Want some advice, honey bear?"
"No," he said, "not from you."
"She's dead."
There was no way he could know that, but he did. Deanie, who had looked like the goddess of the Western world in her thigh-high leather skirt and cork sandals, was dead. He even knew how she had done it. Took pills, pinned up her hair, climbed into a bathtub filled with warm water, went to sleep, slid under. Drowned. The roar of the wind was dreadfully familiar, loaded with hollow threat. Winds blew everywhere, but it only sounded like this in the high country. It was as if some angry god were pounding the world with an air mallet.
"I used to call his booze the bad stuff," Dan thought. "Only sometimes it's the good stuff. When you wake up from a nightmare that you know is at least 50% shining, it's the very good stuff."
One drink would send him back to sleep. 3 would guarantee not just sleep, but dreamless sleep. Sleep was nature's doctor, and right now Dan Torrance felt sick and in need of strong medicine.
"Nothing's open. You lucked out there."
"Well, maybe." He turned on his side and something rolled against his back when he did. No, not something. Someone. Someone had gotten into bed with him. Deanie had gotten into bed with him. Only it felt too small to be Deanie. It felt more like a... He scrambled out of bed, landed awkwardly on the floor, and looked over his shoulder. It was Deanie's little boy, Tommy. The right side of his skull was caved in.
Bone splinters protruded through blood-stained fair hair. Gray scaly muck. Brains was drying on one cheek. He couldn't be alive with such a hellacious wound, but he was. He reached out to Dan with one starfish hand. "Kenny," he said. The screaming began again, only this time it wasn't Deanie, and it wasn't the wind. This time it was him. 12. When he woke for the second time, real waking this time, he wasn't screaming at all, only making a kind of low growling deep in his chest. He sat up gasping, the bedclothes puddled around his waist. There was no one else in his bed, but the dream hadn't yet dissolved and looking wasn't enough. He threw back the bedclothes, and that still wasn't enough. He ran his hands down the bottom sheet, feeling for fugitive warmth or a dent that might have been made by small hips and buttocks. Nothing. Of course not. So then he looked under the bed and saw only his borrowed boots. The wind was blowing less strongly now. The storm wasn't over, but it was winding down. He went to the bathroom, then whirled and looked back, as if expecting to surprise someone. There was just the bed, with the covers now lying on the floor at the foot. He turned on the light over the sink, splashed his face with cold water, and sat down on the closed lid of the commode, taking long breaths, one after the other. He thought about getting up and grabbing a cigarette from the pack lying beside his book on the room's one small table, but his legs felt rubbery and he wasn't sure they'd hold him. Not yet, anyway. So he sat. He could see the bed, and the bed was empty. The whole room was empty. No problem there. Only, it didn't feel empty. Not yet. When it did, he supposed he would go back to bed, but not to sleep. For this night, sleep was done. 13. 7 years before, working as an orderly in a Tulsa hospice, Dan had made friends with an elderly psychiatrist who was suffering from terminal liver cancer. One day when Emil Kimmer had been reminiscing, not very discreetly, about a few of his more interesting cases, Dan had confessed that ever since childhood he had suffered from what he called double dreaming. Was Kimmer familiar with the phenomenon? Was there a name for it? Kimmer had been a large man in his prime. The old black-and-white wedding photo he kept on his bedside table attested to that. But cancer is the ultimate diet program. And on the day of this conversation, his weight had been approximately the same as his age, which was 91. His mind had still been sharp, however, and now, sitting on the closed toilet and listening to the dying storm outside, Dan remembered the old man's sly smile. "Usually," he had said in his heavy German accent, "I am paid for my diagnosis, Daniel." Dan had grinned. "Guess I'm out of luck, then." "Perhaps not." Kimmer studied Dan. His eyes were bright blue. Although he knew it was outrageously unfair, Dan couldn't help imagining those eyes under a Waffen-SS coal scuttle helmet.
"There's a rumor in this death house that you are a kid with a talent for helping people die. Is this true?"
"Sometimes," Dan said cautiously. "Not always." The truth was almost always.
"When the time comes, will you help me?"
"If I can, of course."
"Good."
Kimmer sat up, a laboriously painful process, but when Dan moved to help, Kimmer had waved him away.
"What you call double dreaming is well known to psychiatrists, and of particular interest to Jungians, who call it false awakening. The first dream is usually a lucid dream, meaning the dreamer knows he is dreaming."
"Yes," Dan cried, "but the second one..."
"The dreamer believes he is awake," Kimmer said. "Jung made much of this, even ascribing precognitive powers to these dreams. But of course, we know better, don't we, Dan?"
Of course, Dan had agreed.
The poet Edgar Allan Poe described the false awakening phenomenon long before Carl Jung was born. He wrote, "All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream."
Have I answered your question?
I think so. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Now I believe I could drink a little juice. Apple, please.
14. Precognitive powers. But of course we know better. Even if he hadn't kept the shining almost entirely to himself over the years, Dan would not have presumed to contradict a dying man, especially one with such coldly inquisitive blue eyes. The truth, however, was that one or both of his double dreams were often predictive, usually in ways he only half understood or did not understand at all. But as he sat on the toilet seat in his underwear, now shivering, and not just because the room was cold, he understood much more than he wanted to. Tommy was dead, murdered by his abusive uncle, most likely. The mother had committed suicide not long after. As for the rest of the dream, or the phantom hat he'd seen earlier spinning down the sidewalk. Stay away from the woman in the hat. She's the queen bitch of Castle Hell. I don't care, Dan said. If you mess with her, she'll eat you alive. He had no intention of meeting her, let alone messing with her. As for Deanie, he wasn't responsible for either her short-fused brother or her child neglect. He didn't even have to carry around the guilt about her lousy $70 anymore. She had sold the cocaine. He was sure that part of the dream was absolutely true, and they were square. More than square, actually. What he cared about was getting a drink. Getting drunk, not to put too fine a point on it. Standing up, falling down, pissy-ass drunk. Warm morning sunshine was good, and the pleasant feeling of muscles that had been worked hard and waking up in the morning without a hangover. But the price. All these crazy dreams and visions. Not to mention the random thoughts of passing strangers that sometimes found their way past his defenses. Was too high. Too high to bear. 15. He sat in the room's only chair and read his John Sanford novel by the light of the room's only lamp until the two town churches with bells rang in 7 o'clock. Then he pulled on his new to him anyway, boots and duffel coat. He headed out into a world that had changed and softened. There wasn't a sharp edge anywhere. The snow was still falling, but gently now. I should get out of here. Go back to Florida. Fuck New Hampshire, where it probably even snows on the 4th of July in odd-numbered years. Halloran's voice answered him, the tone as kind as he remembered from his childhood when Dan had been Danny, but there was hard steel underneath. You better stay somewhere, honey, or you won't be able to stay anywhere. Fuck you, old-timer, he muttered. He went back to the Red Apple because the stores that sold hard liquor wouldn't be open for at least another hour. He walked slowly back and forth between the wine cooler and the beer cooler, debating, and finally decided if he was going to get drunk, he might as well do it as nastily as possible. He grabbed 2 bottles of Thunderbird, 18% alcohol, a good enough number when whiskey was temporarily out of reach, started up the aisle to the register, then stopped. Give it one more day. Give yourself one more chance. He supposed he could do that. But why? So he could wake up in bed with Tommy again? Tommy with half his skull caved in? Or maybe next time it would be Deanie, who had lain in that tub for 2 days before the super finally got tired of knocking, used his passkey and found her. He couldn't know that. If Emil Kimmer had been here, he would have agreed most emphatically, but he did. He did know. So why bother? Maybe this hyper-awareness will pass. Maybe it's just a phase, the psychic equivalent of the DTs. Maybe if you just give it a little more time. But time changed That was something only drunks and junkies understood. When you couldn't sleep, when you were afraid to look around because of what you might see, time elongated and grew sharp teeth.
Help you?
The clerk asked, and Dan knew, fucking shining fucking thing, that he was making the clerk nervous. Why not? With his bed head, dark circled eyes, and jerky, unsure movements, he probably looked like a meth freak who was deciding whether or not to pull out his trusty Saturday night special and ask for everything in the register. No, Dan said. I just realized I left my wallet home. He put the green bottles back in the cooler. As he closed it, they spoke to him gently, as one friend speaks to another. See you soon, Danny.
16. Billy Freeman was waiting for him, bundled up to the eyebrows. He held out an old-fashioned ski hat with Anniston Cyclones embroidered on the front.
What the hell are the Anniston Cyclones? Dan asked.
Anniston's 20 miles north of here. When it comes to football, basketball, and baseball, they're our arch rivals. Someone sees that on you, you'll probably get a snowball upside your head, but it's the only one I've got.
Dan hauled it on. Then go, Cyclones.
Right. Fuck you and the hoss you rode in on.
Billy looked him over.
You all right, Dan-o?
Didn't get much sleep last night.
I hear that. Damn wind really screamed, didn't it? Sounded like my ex when I suggested a little Monday night lovin' might do us good. Ready to go to work?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Good. Let's dig in. Gonna be a busy day.
17. It was indeed a busy day, but by noon the sun had come out and the temperature had climbed back into the mid-50s. Teeny Town was filled with the sound of 100 small waterfalls as the snow melted. Dan's spirits rose with the temperature and even caught himself singing, "Young man, I was once in your shoes," as he followed his snowblower back and forth in the courtyard of the little shopping center adjacent to the common. Overhead, flapping in a mild breeze far removed from the shrieking wind of the night before, was a banner reading, "Huge Spring Bargains at Teeny Town Prices." There were no visions. After they clocked out, he took Billy to the chuck wagon and ordered them steak dinners. Billy offered to buy the beer. Dan shook his head. Staying away from alcohol, reason being, once I start, it's sometimes hard to stop.
You could talk to Kingsley about that, Billy said. He got himself a booze divorce about 15 years ago. He's all right now, but his daughter still don't talk to him.
They drank coffee with the meal. A lot of it. Dan went back to his third-floor Elliott Street lair, tired, full of hot food, and glad to be sober. There was no TV in his room, but he had the last part of the Sanford novel and lost himself in it for a couple of hours. He kept an ear out for the wind, but it did not rise. He had an idea that last night's storm had been winter's final shot, which was fine with him. He turned in at 10 and fell asleep almost immediately. His early morning visit to the Red Apple now seemed hazy, as if he had gone there in a fever delirium and the fever had now passed.
18. He woke in the small hours, not because the wind was blowing, but because he had to piss like a racehorse. He got up, shuffled to the bathroom, and turned on the light inside the door.
The top hat was in the tub and full of blood.
No, he said. I'm dreaming. Maybe double dreaming. Or triple. Quadruple, even.
There was something he hadn't told Emo Kimmer. He was afraid that eventually he would get lost in a maze of phantom nightlife and never be able to find his way out again.
All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream.
Only this was real. So was the hat. No one else would see it, but that changed nothing. The hat was real. It was somewhere in the world. He knew it. From the corner of his eye, he saw something written on the mirror over the sink. Something written in lipstick. I must not look at it. Too late.
His head was turning. He could hear the tendons in his neck creaking like old door hinges. And what did it matter? He knew what it said. Mrs. Massey was gone, Horace Derwent was gone, they were securely locked away in the boxes he kept far back in his mind. But the Overlook was still not done with him. Written on a mirror, not in lipstick, but in blood, was a single word. Red rum. Beneath it, lying in the sink, was a blood-stained Atlanta Braves t-shirt. It will never stop, Danny thought. The Overlook burned, and the most terrible of its revenants went into the lockboxes. But I can't lock away the shining, because it isn't just inside me. It is me. Without booze to at least stun it, these visions will go on until they drive me insane. He could see his face in the mirror with red rum floating in front of it, stamped on his forehead like a brand. This was not a dream. There was a murdered child's shirt in his wash basin and a hat full of blood in his tub. Insanity was coming. He could see its approach in his own bulging eyes. Then, like a flashlight beam in the dark, Halloran's voice. Son, you may see things, but they're like pictures in a book. You weren't helpless in Overlook when you were a child, and you're not helpless now. Far from it. Close your eyes, and when you open them, all this crap will be gone. He closed his eyes and waited. He tried to count off the seconds, but only made it to 14 before the numbers were lost in the roaring confusion of his thoughts. He half expected hands, perhaps those of whoever owned the hat, to close around his neck. But he stood there. There was really nowhere else to go. Summoning all his courage, Dan opened his eyes. The tub was empty. The wash basin was empty. There was nothing written on the mirror. But it will be back. Next time, maybe it'll be her shoes. Those cork sandals. Or I'll see her in a tub. Why not? That's where I saw Mrs. Massey, and they died the same way. Except I never stole Mrs. Massey's money and ran out on her. I gave it a day, he told the empty room. I did that much. Yes, and although it had been a busy day, it had also been a good day, he'd be the first to admit it. The days weren't the problem. As for the nights. The mind was a blackboard. Booze was the eraser. 19. Dan lay awake until 6. Then he dressed and once more made the trek to the Red Apple. This time he did not hesitate. Only instead of extracting 2 bottles of Bird from the cooler, he took 3. What was it they used to say? Go big or go home. The clerk bagged the bottles without comment. He was used to early wine purchases. Dan strolled to the town common, sat on one of the benches in Teeny Town, and took one of the bottles out of the bag, looking down at it like Hamlet with Yorick's skull. Through the green glass, what was inside looked like rat poison instead of wine. You say that like it's a bad thing, Dan said, and loosened the cap. This time, it was his mother who spoke up. Wendy Torrance, who had smoked right to the bitter end, because if suicide was the only option, you could at least choose your weapon. Is this how it ends, Danny? Is this what it was all for? He turned the cap widdershins, then tightened it, then back the other way. This time he took it off. The smell of the wine was sour. The smell of jukebox music and crappy bars and pointless arguments followed by fistfights in parking lots. In the end, life was as stupid as one of those fights. The world wasn't a hospice with fresh air. The world was the Overlook Hotel where the party never ended. Where the dead were alive forever. He raised the bottle to his lips. Is this why we fought so hard to get out of that damned hotel, Danny? While we fought to make a new life for ourselves? There was no reproach in her voice, only sadness.
Danny tightened the cap again, then loosened it, tightened it, loosened it. He thought, if I drink, the Overlook wins.